And that's the kicky music that means it's time once again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. And I'm here around the table with the Pop Culture Happy Hour crew. Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And Trey Graham, what do you do at NPR?
I'm the movies editor at the NPR website, and I do various and sundry other little bitty things that nobody ever gets to see.
And Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And you do very high-profile projects that everybody gets to see.
Well, I'm not going to lie to you. I'm a pretty big deal.
good news all around. Well, as we start this week, one of the things that we are heading into is the end of the TV season over the next month or two here. And one of the big events that's on the way, as you may know, is Steve Carell leaving The Office.
I'm sorry, I thought you were going to talk about Gary Busey on Celebrity Apprentice.
Yeah, it's pretty bad.
That's the biggest event of my TV season.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I know it is, but unfortunately that's not true of many. Many people care about the departure of Steve Carell from The Office, Steven. And some of those people are also interested in the fact that Will Ferrell, along with a bunch of other famous people, is coming to The Office at some point shortly for several episodes and will be there heading toward the end of the season. And this got us talking a little bit about stunt casting and the general matter of when a show brings in a famous person, such as Will Ferrell. I think Will Ferrell is a sort of classic example of what I think of as stunt casting, mm-hmm. in that it can be positive or negative, and it really depends. We're thinking on how it's used. So we were going to take a few minutes to just kind of think through the issue of stunt casting. Glenn Weldon, pro or con?
It depends. Certainly Will and Grace was a serial abuser of the stunt casting, bringing in everybody. Per episode, they would keep bringing somebody new. Friends, toward the end of its run, mm-hmm. did it a lot.
Danny DeVito on Friends as the stripper.
Absolutely. And we've already talked on this show about Nathan Lane on Modern Family, how he didn't seem to quite jibe with the tone, with the sensibility of the show. I would add to that list Martin Short on Arrested Development. Uh-huh. Nothing wrong with Martin Short. Martin Short's a very funny guy, but just something about his take.
Well, it pushed that particular episode way over the top.
Exactly. He was mugging. Yeah. I think he would admit.
Is it a matter of being able to fit into the style of the show, that he was too muggy for that show?
I think so.
You know, because I'm going to argue Liza Minnelli on Arrested Development, on the other hand.
Oh, really?
Surprisingly,
kind of awesome.
I was going to say, very pro Liza Minnelli.
Yes, totally.
Yeah, she sort of made that work for her.
I don't know why I thought Trey was going to take an anti Liza Minnelli position.
Well, and the other interesting thing is there are shows where sometimes it works much better than others. I mean, I think 30 Rock is sort of cornering the market on Emmy nominations for guest actors and actresses increasingly. And some of those, I think, have been really successful. John Hamm was very funny on that show.
Mm-hmm. Very successful.
And I don't think anybody else would necessarily have been any funnier if you had just picked a non-famous, great comic actor.
But part of what makes him so funny is that he is somewhat of an understated actor, as opposed to, for example, also on 30 Rock, Nathan Lane.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, and especially when they brought on John Hamm, he was doing that. She talked about how he looks like a cartoon pilot, which is maybe one of my favorite descriptions of a guy ever. The fact that he's this perfect-seeming guy, which I think bleeds into it, that he's got this other role where he's sort of this very sexy man, mm-hmm. I think his place in pop culture and the fact that he has that other role is helpful in deciding that he's going to be the guy where part of what's funny.
He can play off his image.
Right, exactly. Thank you, Stephen Thompson.
Well, the interesting thing about bringing Will Ferrell into The Office is that his wheelhouse is pretty much the man boy with a total lack of self-awareness, but not malice. Underneath, even Ron Burgundy isn't a malicious guy. No. He's just a big child, which is exactly the emotional real estate that Steve Carell has staked out. In the very first season of The American Office, there was a darker tone to it because it was trying to match up with the British Office, which was very self-aware. That character, the Ricky Gervais character in that, David Brent, is very aware of the cameras, how he's coming across, and you get a little bit of sense in the way his eyes sort of jitter to the camera every so often, a sense of kind of self-loathing and knowing exactly who he is. Steve Carell grew out of that into this big, bright, and this is why the show, the American version, is a sunnier, sweeter version.
Yeah.
So bringing in Will Ferrell seems like they're just sort of overlaying it exactly.
That's my concern, too. I feel like it's going to be like having two Michael Scotts for that period of time, which I don't know if I am in favor of that.
When I think of Will Ferrell's comedic persona, it is sort of oafish man-child, like a little more like he's going to knock things over, kind of a little bit of a bull in a china shop. you know, from a physical comedy standpoint. But yeah, otherwise, I guess my issue with what they're doing with The Office this season, where they're kind of winding to this big star-studded departure, is what in God's name do you do next season? Mm-hmm. Because all of this stuff feels very series finale.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, there's already been a lot of talk, has this show kind of run out of steam a little bit? It's been much more uneven in the last couple of seasons.
Right.
Having gone to this very sort of sweeps month place,
right,
and very grand finale place and the end mm-hmm. place, how do you continue that show?
Right. Once you do that with the plot and then sort of layer stunt casting on the top of it,
exactly.
it's hard to dial it back and just be ordinary style good television again.
Yeah, I mean, it was the first episode of season 8 going to be, well, now Phyllis and Stanley are feuding over a coffee cup.
The stunt casting stuff in general can be such a wheeze of old age mm-hmm. for shows. Mm-hmm. Particularly, I think of Will and Grace. You know, occasionally, even on that show, some of them were very successful. I think Matt Damon was hilarious on that show. It's
Agreed.
One of my favorite episodes. Mm-hmm. But then there were all these ones with, like, Jennifer Lopez, and wasn't Madonna on that show?
Possibly. Sandra Bernhardt, for example.
It can be, like we're saying, such a sign of old age that my fear is not just, what do you do next? Can you go back to Phyllis and Stanley with the coffee cup? Is it going to become a sort of revolving door of stunt casting people? Because there are shows that do that successfully, like 30 Rock, which usually I think many of them work well, Carrie Fisher and some of the other people they've had. But obviously there have also been some duds there, I would say.
Yeah, I think, Aniston. You know, what it boils down to is, I think, how much of an overlap there is between that chiming off the public persona and the skill and quality week to week of the writers. Right. How much you're able to sort of exploit that chiming within the sort of natural playing field of the show. Make sense? Mm-hmm. Sometimes stunt casting is good casting by definition. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's really, really clear when it's just dumb stunt casting. You know, Elizabeth Taylor on The Nanny is a thing that we discussed recently. But we've also talked about Elizabeth Taylor on General Hospital,
mm-hmm.
which is, you know, maybe arguably still stunt casting for the sake of stunt casting. But James Franco on whatever soap he was on, I can't remember what
also
soap he
General
was on.
Hospital.
Oh, okay. See, I couldn't remember what soap he was on because I remember the conversation about the character he was playing, mm-hmm. whether it was part of a larger performance art piece, mm-hmm. how it fit in with, you know, what that guy is doing with his life. And to me, that gets way over the bar.
Right.
Certainly
right.
When Batman and Robin showed up on Scooby-Doo. I saw it for the cynical sham ploy that it was.
How old were you at the time?
I think it was like 6.
When, you were aware of cynical sham ploys?
I certainly was.
Well, of course.
Of course
it was Glenn Weldon, yes.
I stood up at the television, I pointed, I said, Jacques Hughes. But I still ate it up with a big old spoon because it's Batman and Robin.
That's really interesting because Scooby-Doo is another show mm-hmm. where, as it aged...
Oh,
That's how it became like the, hey, it's Sonny and Cher,
it's
right?
Sonny and Cher. Thanks, Don Knotts.
I would never have thought of Scooby-Doo as another show that aged into overuse of stunt casting, but it was really.
But there
it's been there.
It was really.
And arguably, the related phenomenon is that when a celebrity comes on as his or herself, mm-hmm. you always use both names. This is my favorite thing about when the celebrities come on. You do it in real life anyway, but it's really noticeable on television. And this goes back to the golden age of television. This is like, now, Lucy, I don't want you bothering Tennis Ernie Ford when Tennis Ernie Ford comes to the club for the Tennis Ernie Ford show. She's a tribute to Tennis Ernie Ford. You know? That's like a thing.
Very good.
Or, Ethel, Danny Thomas wouldn't be caught dead in a dump like this. Danny Thomas? You know, that kind of thing. But now I look for them. The most famous example of this, of course, was on One Tree Hill, which was much talked about on The Soup. Stay out of it, Nick Lachey. That's what it is.
True. They played that over and over again. But that's certainly not a new phenomenon, because when I started thinking about this, I remembered Nancy Reagan going on Different Strokes.
Well, yeah, sure.
Talk about Don't Do Drugs and Just Say No and all that stuff. And I believe Mr. T was on Different Strokes mm-hmm. also, possibly as himself. Not positive, mm-hmm. that's right, but, you know.
I would like to posit an exception to all judgments about stunt casting, though,
mm-hmm.
and that is stunt casting has no meaning whatsoever when applied to a certain population of British actors of a certain age, right?
Okay.
You get the sense that these people like the work, that there's just less pretension about art making for these people. I mean, there's no shame for Maggie Smith in being Maggie Smith in whatever she was most recently Maggie Smith in.
Right.
Romeo and Juliet, for instance.
Yeah.
It's work for her, it's entertainment for us, and that's great. Mm-hmm. And in general, they class up the joint. So it's not stunt casting because they're playing themselves. It's stunt casting because it's Maggie Smith voicing a garden gnome.
Julie Andrews, I would say, might be another one who has done some voice work and some appearances where it's like, oh, hey, it's Julie Andrews. That's nice.
But it's still surreal when it happens, though. There's still this little disconnect where it's like, Maggie Smith is on Reba, or whatever.
Great. But it's just a natural outgrowth of the fact there's like maybe 16 British actors in the world. So eventually you kind of
you may hog all the work.
Exactly. Yeah, that's all we know. Obviously, if any of you have examples of stunt casting that you think worked well or badly, we would be happy to hear all about them.
Does it count as stunt casting when they put Iggy Pop on American Idol?
No. You just want to say Iggy Pop on American Idol. I know you do.
Just want to remind the public that Iggy Pop was just on American
Idol. It's true. It's very true.
I don't even know what to say beyond reciting that fact.
That would not count. But if you have good or bad examples of stunt casting, or if you have opinions about Iggy Pop on American Idol, or, of course, opinions about Will Ferrell on The Office, because who doesn't have an opinion about that? You can find us on Facebook. That's at facebook.com/PCHH, or you can find us on the blog at MonkeyC. Leave us a comment, and we promise to read it carefully and think about how smart you are.
And do nothing else.
And do nothing else. That's pretty much all we do. So what we have on the table next, and I think that this will be fun for everyone, because this is the part where you get to scream at your audio device that we are all horrible, horrible fools. We are calling this segment My Most Indefensible Position. Obviously, we don't really think these positions are indefensible, or we would not hold them. And...
or defend them.
I was going to say. And we're about to defend them. So we don't really think they're indefensible. But we do know that many of you may think that they are indefensible. So these are our most unpopular theories.
These are, I cling to this stupid opinion.
I cling to my stupid opinion. Glenn Weldon, what stupid opinion do you cling to?
Well, my position as a staunch defender of Aquaman, King of the Seven Seas, is a matter of public record, so I'm not going to go into it here. Years ago, I used to go to the mat over a movie called Joe versus the Volcano as a very smart, very funny film. I no longer need to go to that mat because Nathan Rabin, in his book My Year of Flops, has defended that film very well.
Oh, I think the public opinion has fully come around on Joe versus the Volcano, I think.
Good to know.
So we don't have to give Nathan another shout-out on the show.
We said in the pre-show talk that we didn't want to make this about, I hate this thing that everybody loves, because that's negative and reductive. So we're going to leave on the table my pitched white-hot hatred for a show called The Golden Girls. You heard it. You heard it. You heard
Glenn Weldon.
Judas!
See, this is it. This is why. I've never told another soul that, but I'm saying it now. I hate it. I hate it. I hate it. I hate it. But
thank you for being no friend.
I hate the fact that I'm expected to like it because of the gay thing. I also hate, what's the word? It. I hate it. but we're not gonna pick
it
up.
I used to like you.
We're not gonna pick it up. Nope.
It's over.
Nope. Yeah. That would be too reductive. And I am going to, on the other hand, get over it.
Show's over. We're just running out the
get
clock.
Get out.
We're just running out the clock.
I hate it so
point.
Much. Instead, I am going to challenge the conventional wisdom which has accreted around a specific television show. The name of that show, Twin Peaks. The conventional wisdom, if I may summarize, is that it was kind of cool and atmospheric in its first little 8-episode arc. We're asked the question, who killed Laura Palmer? Then it went off for a summer, came back, and when it did, the conventional wisdom is it held on to the mystery too long. When it eventually got around to answering it, it was no longer interesting, and then it kind of cycled and didn't know what it was about, and it died an ignominious ratings death. Mm-hmm. I challenge this. What that reading ignores is when in American history, in television, this show was on. Mm-hmm. The lead into the show was, for much of its run, the Father Dowling Mysteries. It was opposite.
I forgot that.
Yes,
it was opposite Cheers. It was opposite, at some point, Carol Burnett and Company. It was opposite Empty Nest. It was opposite Totally Hidden Video. So This show was the first show, I would argue, that decided that it would take a writer's medium, television, and try to turn it into a director's medium. Remember, this was before, it's not TV, it's HBO. It was before any kind of cable series, your Damages, your Shields, and what have you.
Sure.
At the height of the show, about 33% of the American public, viewing public, was watching Twin Peaks. Now, imagine that. 1 in 3 television sets were being exposed to some very weird, dark, surreal imagery.
Lynchian
imagery, exactly. But I can remember watching the episode, I think it was the 3rd episode, where Agent Cooper has a dream that's very dark with a little man from another place, and there's all kinds of screaming and weirdness and people backwards talking. and just loving the fact that 33% of the American public was seeing this piece of art. They had never probably ever seen any Fellini. They'd never seen any Louis Buñuel, you know, Lucien Andelou, none of that. They were seeing this. I was in college at the time at a group house, and I just started rolling around on the floor, just taking in this weirdness, this surreal imagery. And that floor, by the way, was sickening. So just that goes to tell you just how far I was. I think I got pregnant rolling around on that floor.
Are you saying you like this better than the Golden Girls?
I did. I am. In fact, I'm saying that very loudly. It had a look that aspired to film. It had cinematography. It also taught, I think, American television makers something about what to do with a central mystery. Mark Frost and David Lynch were always saying, the show isn't really about Laura Palmer. That's just a MacGuffin. You know, we're really about the town and the atmosphere and the feeling. And everybody was like, yeah, sure. But they were enraptured by this central mystery. And that's something that television makers need to know, which is that a central mystery trumps everything else. The pull of narrative makes us want to find out. And all the stuff you're doing, even if it's wonderful and engaging, is going to be so engaging that we're going to not notice all the other stuff you're doing. I think that's a lesson that certainly The X-Files did not learn by just not knowing where it was going. And you could argue that Lost learned that lesson by parceling out the bits of the mystery enough over the course of its run. If you go back and watch this show knowing what the answer to the central mystery is, you can really appreciate what it was doing, how it achieved this mood when it ended. It was not the same show it was when it began, but it was an interesting show that was going in a slightly different direction. It was trying to figure out what it was, and it was on the very last episode, which is pretty harrowing television, it really started to kind of find its legs again, and then it got canceled.
I'm going to go to myself next.
Good.
Because my indefensible position is that the end of Lost was awesome.
Okay.
And what brought this to mind was a little Twitter thing that was happening between Damon Lindelof, who's one of the producers of Lost, and George R. R. Martin, who's the author of Game of Thrones, which are being made into this massive HBO thing that's about to start. And apparently Martin had given some interview in which he had basically talked about the fear of screwing up the ending and had referred to it as doing a Lost, where the ending is just completely horrible and whatever. He then gave an explanation of why the ending of Lost made him so angry that, in my opinion, demonstrated that he did not understand the ending of Lost.
Mm-hmm.
He misunderstood what they were saying about the ending of Lost. And I found it extremely frustrating because, to me, given the massive nature of the task that they took on with Lost, the intricacy of what they constructed, it was never going to be something where everything was going to make perfect literal sense. It wasn't going to be like The Sixth Sense, where when you get the answer to the mystery, you can go back and say every single thing makes sense and ties into that ending. It was a show that was on for multiple seasons, and they didn't always know how many more seasons it was going to be on. It's impossible to write a perfectly constructed mystery in that kind of structure.
Mm-hmm.
But I felt that despite a few missteps, and I do not deny that, the ending, for the most part, felt exactly the way I wanted it to feel. I thought there were some beautiful character moments in the last few episodes. And although I don't necessarily think it was an unqualified success, I'm really, really bothered by the idea of this working its way into pop culture memory that the ending of Lost was some kind of terrible disaster. Because when it happened, the critical response to it, and to some degree the fan response to it, was very mixed at first. But there were quite a number of people who, when they went back and they watched it again and they thought about it sort of in the light of day, they came around on it more. Or at least they came around on the idea that, like I said, although it was flawed, there were a lot of beautiful things in it. And there was a lot of, as you say, a lot of art in it.
Hmm. Is that changing the calculus in an important way? Because I used to say, and I still say in most cases, that if your intricately constructed piece of art doesn't land with the audience, it's your fault, not theirs.
I think there's a difference between didn't land with the audience and didn't land with everybody who makes comments on the internet.
Sure.
I mean, I think you have to differentiate between the millions and millions and millions of people who are watching that show and it's literally a few hundred who are passionately devoted to going from site to site to site and being the loudest and noisiest commenters. That few hundred number is an estimate, I admit. You'd be surprised how you can go from site to site and you realize you're seeing the same people. Mm-hmm. And although there were a lot of dissatisfied people, I'm certainly not saying a few hundred people are the only people who hated the ending of Lost. I'm just saying you can't conclude based on the relatively small sample that goes out and complains publicly that the ending didn't land with the audience, I think. From my perspective, the vitriol that's been hurled over that ending is massively disproportionate to whatever flaws it had and fails to appreciate maybe the thought that went into it. But I definitely see your point that when the audience doesn't like it, I generally agree with that, that when the audience doesn't like it, it's your fault and not theirs. And I don't like the whole you watched the show incorrectly. I'm not doing that. I hate the idea that it would be remembered as having an unqualifiedly terrible ending.
Right.
Because
sure.
I don't think it did.
I would argue that when you build your piece of art around a mystery that you are going to eventually tell us the answer to, you're running on some pretty cheap fuel that really sends the audience ahead very quickly, but so quickly that when the answer comes, it's going to be inevitably a disappointment. So a show that can hold up once you know the answer and you can go back and revisit and you can start to pick up the things you were just not ignoring because you wanted to get the answer, the answer, the answer, the answer. I think Lost is a show like that, and I certainly think Twin Peaks is a show like
that. Right.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I don't think it still has one answer. And the other thing that frustrates me, obviously, about the way this ending gets talked about is that there is a strain of thought that goes, I didn't like the ending, therefore I wasted 6 years of my life watching it. And to those people, I have always wanted to say, if you're watching the show and you're not enjoying it, but the reason that you're watching it is you're thinking, someday there's going to be a payoff that's going to make all this slogging through these six seasons worth it, you should not be watching that show.
Yeah.
You should only be watching it if you're enjoying it as you go, if you're enjoying the performances and the writing and all that stuff. And if you are, then even if you're disappointed in the ending, to me, it's unwise to allow that to go back and and suck all of your enjoyment out of it. That is my indefensible position. My indefensible position. Stephen Thompson, what's your indefensible position?
There is a noisy pocket of the internet that agrees with me on this. So I'm somewhat piggybacking on a noisy pocket of the internet. I have also written to the effect that I've stated.
You've written to the authorities about this noisy pocket?
Yes, I probably should. I have written about my belief in this. It still remains, I think, a very marginal position, and that is that Weird Al Yankovic should be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
There you go.
And that it is basically ludicrous that he is not. This is a man. I don't have a whole monologue prepared here.
This is a man.
This is a man. This great man has stood before us. Imagine a career that spans 35 years in which you riff on the popular music of the day for 35 years and have this string of hit after hit after hit. Now, there are certainly flops along the way, which, if anything, makes it more remarkable that his career,
he's had so many hits,
that his best-selling album came out in, I think, what, 2006?
Mm-hmm.
The one with White and Nerdy, the Straight Outta Linwood, came out in 2006. His first aired song came out in 1976.
That's a long career.
Yeah, 3 decades of staying right on top of the pop culture musical styles and, you know, and reaching a mass audience with it. He's right up there with Lawrence Welk.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
it's going to be a fight.
Oh, Trey, man.
Well, no,
I'm sorry. We'll get to Trey's controversial position about the opera in just a moment.
I'm gonna break this fight up by mentioning at this point that we ran a post on Monkey See one time that was written by Mark Hirsch, one of our writers, who called it Weird Al Yankovic, a stealth musicologist.
Yes.
And it was about how much you have to understand and know about styles of music in order to be able to do that, and that few people have the ability to pick up enough about a style of music to write a successful parody.
Yeah. Well, one thing that I note in the liner notes to the essential the essential Weird Al Yankovic, and one thing that I noted in there
is, bless you, Thompson.
I will die on this hill. To do great parody, you have to be able to emulate the thing you are parodying as well as the people who created the thing that you are parodying. And if you can't, the parody just
just
like topples like a house of cards. And so the fact
you certainly can't sustain it for 3.5 to 4 minutes,
right?
Or 3.5 to 4 decades, as Weird Al Yankovic and his band, which has it's the same band that he had in like 1982, mm-hmm. is the band that he has now, has been able to perfectly emulate Nirvana and Madonna. I mean, not that he's perfectly emulating Michael Jackson, but he is very effectively emulating the rapid-fire rapping style of Chamillionaire.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It is an absolutely remarkable career. It is a one-of-a-kind career. And I think when you combine sales, cultural impact, he's not like anyone else who is in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. If we've decided that the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is an important thing, and you know, just as you know, we can have the debate over whether the Grammys are an important thing. Mm-hmm. He has won 3 of them mm-hmm. over the course of many, many years. Been nominated for 9. I'm sorry. Wikipedia tells me that he's been nominated for 9. I have not memorized all of these statistics, but if his Wikipedia page is any indication, he's had a very successful career. He belongs in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Thank you, Steve.
Case closed.
2 points. One, listeners should know that Stephen has been sawing the air like a mop-top Mussolini. Second, why isn't he? What's keeping him out of there?
I think stodginess. I blame the stodgy.
Yeah.
Like all arguments pertaining to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and the Grammys and any other music-related authority, I blame the stodgy.
There you go.
And the thing is, if Weird Al Yankovic made the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, I've always argued this sort of point. I would say the same thing about the Pulitzers and other bestowers of massive...
Credibility.
Thank you. Yeah. Exactly what I was looking for. That they would be... so much more. A lot of the picks they make are made in order to generate discussions. And if you reach outside of the scope of, you know, this year, we, you know, it is time for us to induct the Ramones. It's like, yeah, it's been 25 years. Mm-hmm. That makes sense. But if you give an award like that to somebody unexpected, if mm-hmm. you give a Pulitzer to an unexpected recipient, mm-hmm. if you give, you know, a Peabody or a Grammy or whatever to an unexpected, that actually gets talked about more than if you just award the canon.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But if you stretch the definition of the canon to say, look at this incredibly remarkable career, how on earth has this guy done this?
Right.
People would talk about that. And I think it would ultimately bestow more credibility onto the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame to acknowledge somebody with that kind of career.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Trey Graham, what is your most indefensible position?
Well, let the record show that the whole Lawrence Welk thing was a straw man. I don't have any significant disagreement with Thompson's
argument. Just don't want me to mock your opera.
It is true that I have been heard to argue that the Leontine Price recording of Isolde's Liebestod is pretty darn good.
Yeah, but
which
Trey, that's
earns
not
me
come...
no respect at all with the Wagner nerds.
Right. But Trey, that's not going to come as any surprise to anyone who knows anything about German art song.
It's not art song, it's opera. Keep your genres straight.
Still great. Go ahead.
Anyway, I've been told that I should talk less about my strange music fetishes on this podcast. So.
By whom?
Go ahead, Trey Graham.
I will say instead that one of the fights I have all the time, and sometimes just with myself, is about Ragtime, the Broadway musical based on the E.L. Doctorow novel. It got middling reviews the first time around, although it had what I would argue is one of the most glamorous casts in the history of the Broadway musical theater. Audra McDonald, Brian Stokes Mitchell, Maren Mazzie were 3 of the leads. Judy Kaye was a supporting player. I was so smitten with the show, I cannot tell you. I was there on opening night, and I was completely bowled over by the show. Anyway, one critic, who shall remain nameless, but whose initials are Bob Mondello.
his name begins with a B and ends in Ob Mondello.
Yes, indeed. He argued right away that this was kind of a lumpy show, that its heart was too much on its sleeve, and that there are too many big ballads all in a row, and that all the rest of the music sounds the same. And to that I say, poo.
Oh, it's getting real.
I grant you that Ragtime
poo
was,
just got real.
Poo. I grant you the show is long. I grant you that the book of the show by Terrence McNally mm-hmm. is a little thick with the lessons about melting pots and how some very different people from very different backgrounds come together in some very surprising ways and how that's what makes America great. I am still a fan of this show. I am obviously not the only fan of this show. It does have its partisans. And there was enough interest in it that when the Kennedy Center revived it a couple of years ago, the production went back to Broadway. So that's 2, count them, 2 full Broadway productions in the course of a decade, people. There. I am, however, what I think is a fairly small number of critics who like the show. And even now that I can see its flaws, I think that it's kind of wonderful in its excesses. It is absolutely fond of its tricks, but they are awfully good tricks. The characters connect. It is a moving story. The percentage of music that is just flat-out glorious is eye-openingly high. It's like Rent in that way. You can complain about there's a lot going on, and okay, I get it already, but there's not much stuff about this show that, taken on its own and examined piece by piece for quality, does not hold up.
Very good. I like it.
I love that there's no conversation to be had about this show.
I got nothing on that.
Thank you all very much.
I have seen Ragtime. I thought it was fine.
Read the book.
I enjoyed it, and I support you.
Okay, fine.
Just because I have faith in you. We are going to, very quickly, we've got about 5 minutes for this. We're going to go like lightning. Hmm. Lightning round. I got a little game for you.
Nope.
Game time. We got a game.
Game.
All right. This game is called Drink or Duke. And the question that you are answering is whether this item is a cocktail, as found in a lovely online cocktail database, or a character played by John Wayne in a movie. Everybody ready?
Gotcha.
Banana Pete.
Drink.
That is a drink made with banana rum and cola. Ah. How about Boozer Bob?
Drink.
I'm going to say drink, yeah.
That is a drink made with Jägermeister, Merlot, and Sprite.
Oh,
which I included partly just because, wow. Johnny Monroe.
It's got to be the Duke. Got to be the Duke.
That is the Duke. It's the character he played in Tycoon. Jack Withers.
I'd say
I'm going to say drink.
Duke.
Duke.
The answer is it is a drink.
Yes!
Made with gin, dry and sweet vermouth, and orange juice.
Oh, Thompson's killing this.
Thompson is. Cowboy Roy.
I gotta get a drink.
I'm gonna go Duke.
Drink.
And the answer is vodka. Rum and orange juice in a Cowboy Roy.
God, if I had gotten that one right, I would have proven the greatest drink or Duke savant.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Next
in at
up,
least 10 years.
Yeah. Next up, Lumberjack.
Drink.
Duke.
That is the character he played in Rough Romance.
Good Lord.
Trey Graham, butcher than Stephen Thompson.
Many have argued that on the internet.
Okay. Captain Pepper.
Drink.
Drink.
Duke.
Drink. Made from rum and Dr. Pepper, logically enough. Because who wouldn't drink rum and Dr. Pepper? Okay. Next up, Captain Dooley.
Duke.
That is the character played by the Duke in Island in the Sky, Biff Smith.
Duke. I want it to be the Duke.
I'm going
to
say drink just to be contrary.
Played by John Wayne in
Seriously?
California.
John Wayne played
ahead.
A character named Biff?
Biff Smith. Guy Punch.
That's a drink.
I want that to be a Duke
it would
character
be awesome,
so much.
Awesome if that were a Duke character.
I admit that's a little bit of a misdirect. Vodka, incidentally, if you care. Vodka, triple sec, limes, grenadine, and Red Bull.
Oof.
Go into that one. Let's see what else is on my list here. I got Robert Marmaduke Hightower.
Oh, that's the Duke.
I'm gonna say Duke.
Played by John Wayne in Three Godfathers.
Very few drinks have a middle name.
And finally, Colonel Davy Crockett.
Say drink.
Oh,
Duke.
Duke.
Played by John Wayne in The Alamo. Yeah. And we'll leave it there with the game, drink or Duke. Drink. Y'all did very well.
Yeah.
Y'all did very well. Although you split on many answers, mm-hmm. which meant that someone did well, no matter whether anyone did well or not. And now it's time for our final segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? I'm going to start over here with Stephen Thompson.
If that's the case, then Glenn Weldon is going to have to leave the room.
No.
Go ahead, Thompson. Hit it.
What is making me happy is Glenn Weldon's Twitter feed.
No. No.
Is this yours, too?
This is totally mine.
Oh, yeah. Well, we're just going to... It would have been mine, too. I had to ask Stephen today if this is going to be his.
Seriously, people, it is no accident that Glenn picked up how many Twitter followers in one day?
Oh, my God.
You know, it was about a thousand.
About a thousand Twitter followers. Now, why did Glenn gain 1,000 Twitter followers? Was there some massive reason? It's entirely through retweeting.
Mm-hmm.
People retweeting Glenn's meme. Did you create this meme, Glenn, or is
yes.
this?
I did.
Okay. He did.
The meme, it has the hashtag during the government shutdown. And consists entirely of sort of dystopian, sort of post-apocalyptic Washington, D.C.
Yes, this, I described it in my notes as last week's horrifying Glenn Weldon exercise in post-apocalyptic Twitter impressionism.
Mm-hmm.
Let's read a few.
Linda,
you want to read? Why don't I? I'll start.
You can go.
I'll start with a representative one. Rooks strip gobbets of flesh from the heads of speechwriters as they're carried through the streets on pikes.
During the government
shutdown.
During the government shutdown. During the government shutdown.
I think I can do this one from memory. At the National Zoo, a grim, battle-hardened Nancy Pelosi sheaths her knife. No, cackles.
Lights a
cheroot as she guts a panda. During the government shutdown.
During the government shutdown.
In a Smithsonian sub-basement, gibbering bat-winged creatures stockpile astronaut ice cream for a dark ritual.
The other one, and this one I might be able to do almost from memory, is shadows undulate in the windows of the National Press Club, swaying to a music man was not meant to hear.
During the government shutdown.
From his airship, Clarence Thomas surveys the damage and whispers, "Good. Good," over his tented fingers.
So there's a formula there that as soon as I figured it out, it's a part Edward Gorey, it's part H.P. Lovecraft, it's part Mad Max, it's a little bit of a thing.
Politico.
If I knew more about how government works, it would have been funnier because I would have been able to be more specific, but I just had to keep it kind of at the level of stuff that I know, that I've heard of before. Thank you, that's very nice to say.
In the slanting golden light of late afternoon, the corpse mounds along the mall give off a sullen red gleam.
I did find out this is how far Twitter has come with just useless metrics. I was the, according to Follow Friday, the 152nd most followed Friday thing last week.
Alrighty then.
152nd. Like, what am I going to do with that? What do you do with 152nd? It's like we are collecting far too much information. We don't know what to do with it.
You deserved every...
Take that, Huffington Post!
You deserved to be 151st.
Oh, that was very nice. Now, again, most of these people are local DC, you know, people who got it, picked it up through DCist or whatever like that. And I'm going to lose them. I know, because they're not my people. I know I'm going to lose them as soon as I start making stupid fish puns again.
No way.
Audie Cornish, who's on Capitol Hill covering the government shutdown, I sort of tweeted out, "Have you seen this?" And she responded back almost immediately, "So good, hashtag, it might get me fired."
Yeah. So that's what's making Stephen happy this week. It was also, would have been what's making me happy. And turns out it was what was making Trey happy. So do you want to serve up anything else, Trey? Or
that was my introductory. That was my introductory what's making me happy.
Well, so what is making us happy is twitter.com/GH Weldon.
That's true. It's true. Not afraid to root for the home team in this particular situation. Yep. Trey Graham, do you have another?
I had a B segment, which was just the observation that Michael Shannon is playing General Zod.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I figure this will make several people in the room happy.
That seems like a very good idea.
Yeah. And to continue with my other theme of the day, Stephen Sondheim's Company, the concert staging in New York from roughly a week ago by the time you hear this, with Christina Hendricks and many, many other awesome people like Katie Finneran and John Cryer and Stephen Colbert. It is coming to a theater near you, people. If you are gay, you know this already. And you will find the locations and times without needing the Google, because something in your vestigial reptile brain responded when Patti LuPone committed the ladies to lunch to film in the company of the New York Philharmonic and Neil Patrick Harris.
Oh, I just want to say, if part of you is gay, you just found out.
But if you're not, for instance, me, you'll need to mark your calendar for June 15th and consult your local theatrical guide.
Very good. Very good. Excellent. Thank you, Trey.
And I mean
Graham.
A movie theater near you, people.
Right. Because they're going to play it in movie theaters.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Excellent. Glenn Weldon, other than being awesome, what's making you happy this week?
Validation.
That didn't suck.
Yeah.
I wanted to review this book for the site. I'm not going to get a chance to, but I want to give it a shout out here. Ben Catcher has a new book. He's a strip cartoonist. He does weekly cartoon strips for a lot
I'm
of
sure
alt weeklies.
Strip cartoonist doesn't mean the same thing. Doesn't, it sounds like it means.
Doesn't mean. This is his first book in about 10 years. If listeners know him, they probably know him from a strip he does for the Village Voice and other alt weeklies called Julius Knipple, Real Estate Photographer. which is about, you know, living in a city in this kind of surreal way that cities sort of suggest things are going on around you that you don't quite understand. This new book, as again, his first in 10 years, is called The Cardboard Valise, from a collection of other strips he did that ended in 2000, but he's added to it to create a sort of a through line, a narrative through line. But it's a very weird, oblique narrative through line, because this book is very surreal, not in a Lynchian sense, but in a quiet, contemplative, warm, I would say, sense. It's about travel. It's about what we take with us when we go to a different place. One of the characters travels to an island that was colonized by paper towel salesmen.
Mm-hmm.
And that on this island, tourists visit the ruins of public restrooms built in the 1970s. So the word dreamlike gets tossed around a lot, but here it really sticks. There's an unhurried, quiet, strange way that this book sort of connects to each other. There's a real poetry to his words and to his images. It's a book that you want to curl up with, you want to pore over, you want to lose yourself in. I just open to a random page. Somebody's describing one of the pastimes in one of these faraway lands. It is a sport that combines the thrill of the merry-go-round with the danger of ordering a sandwich in an unfamiliar coffee shop. So this is just really a very specific tone, a very specific vision, but I just love it. It's called The Cardboard Valise by Ben Katcher, K-A-T-C-H-O-R. And in an unusual move, Pantheon has also released an ebook version of this graphic novel, which is happening more and more.
Very good. Well, what is making me happy this week, I wrote today on the blog about the fact that the first thing that's making me happy is going to my local library,
mm-hmm.
my local public library.
Yeah, funny how you talked about how much you love libraries on the first day of library week.
I had no idea it was library week. I truly didn't. I had no idea it was library week.
So this isn't part of our campaign to suck up to librarians?
It's not.
For to
it
increase
truly
the size
was
of our
not.
Audience?
It actually was part of a campaign to not spend $40 to read the rest of a series of romance novels that I really, really found that I wanted to read. The cost $13 each on like Kindle. Oof. And I was like, I can't do it.
And to be fair, our listeners aren't just librarians. There are also information specialists. Archivists.
That's true. So that was A. But B is, everybody knows, I think, that Tina Fey's book Bossy Pants came out last week. And rather than purchase it or get it as an ebook or anything like that, I went with the audiobook because it is read by Tina Fey. And I have to say, specifically as an audiobook, this is a great example of why, with some people, you actually should have the audiobook. Obviously, it's Tina Fey. She adopts so many different voices and attitudes and things like that I find myself thinking, boy, if I were reading this as just the text, I think I would get a lot less out of it. If you didn't know exactly where she was going with the style and when she kind of does a little girl voice and when she kind of is doing a breathy voice, and she shifts delivery frequently. It's not just a narration. I'm not quite at the end of the book yet, but they have a sound clip of the entire first Sarah Palin sketch so that you can actually hear it right as she's talking about it. There are a lot of advantages to the audiobook in this case. So what's making me happy this week is the Bossy Pants audiobook. Mm-hmm. And if you've never tried an audiobook before, might be a good one to track down, might be one that might get you hooked on the format. So I'm going to say the Bossy Pants audiobook.
Nice.
And that brings us to the end of Pop Culture Happy Hour. And you can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me and the blog at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Trey at Trey Graham. That is Trey with an E, and Graham like the cracker. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen. That's S-T-E-P-H-E-N. You can follow our esteemed producer, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff. That's K-A-T-Z-I-F. You can follow Glenn Weldon at G-H Weldon. That's W-E-L-D-O-N, but you probably already are.
Yeah.
Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in-and-out music that we love so much and that many of you want to see made into a ringtone.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Pass that along, Mike Katziff. And thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you, and we will see you next week.